Meeting of the House Special Committee on Oil and Gas called to order January 23rd, 10:02 a.m. For the record, the committee members present are, and would you do roll call or? Yes, roll call, please.
Chair Hodgins.
Here.
Representative Oga.
Here.
Representative Roper.
Here.
Representative Bryce.
Here.
Representative Ryan.
Here.
Representative Kaplan.
Here.
Representative Bundy.
Thank you. Do we have any notification of what did we receive? Okay. Okay, on today's calendar, we have a few housekeeping measures, being that this is the first oil and gas subcommittee meeting of this session, of the new session. I am the chairman, Mark Hodgins, and I'd like to lay out a little bit of my philosophy as to what I'd like to do with the committee for just a few minutes, if you'll bear with me. I hope to use this committee not only for the legislative and resolutions that normally come forward in the course of business of the House of Representatives, but I would also like to use this committee as a point on lease sales, where this committee gets out and conducts hearings for the lease sales coming up in Cook Inlet and the North Slope as they come up, to give information and to give the citizens an extra opportunity to testify and to possibly forestall some of the negative reactions we have to some of our lease sales due to inaccurate information. Another thing that I would like to do with this committee is to become a liaison between government and industry. And what we would do is, if somebody in government doesn't understand public policy, it's the intentions of this committee to go forward and to question them on how they arrived at their public policy, and to make sure that government is adhering to good public policy as prescribed by the administration and the legislature. I would also ask that that we consider a vice chair for this committee. My schedule will sometimes preclude me from being here, and to keep the flow of the committee going, I would like for you gentlemen on the committee to give me an indication if you'd like to be a vice chair, and then we can go ahead and go forward with that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Regan.
I chaired way too much vice in the legislature last year, so I would nominate Representative Roper.
Okay. Is there anybody care to be a vice chair? We'll just have a simple vote, or we can take this up at another time. But
yes,
give me some thoughts.
Right. We will. I'd be happy to discuss it.
Great. Okay, that would take us on to House Joint Resolution 12, leases in the National Petroleum Reserve. Do we have the it's under my understanding we're on a teleconference, is that correct? So we have, do we have anybody to that has signed up on the teleconference?
I think your moderator is right here.
Okay. First item of business today is the leases in the National Petroleum Reserve. Members of the public wishing to testify on the bill before the committee today who have not signed up to witness the witness register, please do so. Pat, we have the sign-up sheet out in the hall. Please print your name, address, telephone number, agency, and the number of people on the teleconference. We'll have that as a list also. Okay, do we have Representative Green or a representative from his office? We'll take an at ease just a moment.
I say we
order. I see that we have joined us as Representative Bundy, and we have Representative Green. We will be discussing House Joint Resolution number 12. I'd like to make a sponsor statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for being late. There was miscommunication. I thought there was going to be another bill ahead of mine, so I was feverishly putting in order, I hope, that which I was going to present to you. I think in your packets, you have several issues pertaining to this. And I would draw your attention first to the map that looks kind of like this, so that we can kind of get a lay of the land, as it were. And I would point out some of the features that we're talking about. And while you're finding that, the NPRA, as it's called now since the mid-80s, was prior, so that there won't be any confusion, NPR-4, which at that time was established as a Naval Petroleum Reserve Number 4 by Warren G. Harding, 1923. The others are in California and Wyoming, and they were established originally as a place to find oil that would supply our naval forces. And so from the early inception, dating clear back to the 1800s, with oil seeps located up near the top, if you look at Barrow and then go over where it says Dease Inlet, Simpson Lagoon is an area there that actually shows a name, Sinclair. Well, it's about in that area. And there is in your packet a Xerox copy, unfortunately. It was a color photo, and it didn't Xerox very well. But at any rate, there have been natural seeps in the Naval Petroleum Reserve, excuse me, now the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. And because of that, there was some interest exhibited early on. There was a USGS report made indicating the potential from a geological standpoint, that is, that the source rock, the types of reservoirs and so on were available, and that was part of a greater study that covered the entire North Slope. Well, all of us are certainly aware of what ultimately came from that was the discovery of Prudhoe Bay back in 1968. But prior to that, there had been two or three sinusoidal curves of interest in NPRA. And dating back to this study that was done by, of all things, a fellow named Brooks, and you may recall that there is a rather significant geological feature now in his name, the Brooks Range, did a study in 1901, published in 1903, indicating that this was a geological province capable of containing hydrocarbons. GS published another issue in 1909, and then Leffingwell, if you happen to have any earth science background, Leffingwell is a very cherished name in Alaska because of all the geological work he did, all having to do with the North Slope, and primarily the Naval Petroleum, excuse me, I keep referring to that naval, to the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. In the early 20s, because of our preeminence as a nation getting more and more involved after World War I in world affairs, and the potential for the Pacific Rim development, there was renewed interest in the Petroleum Reserve, and so there was a flurry of excitement for about 3 years. Some discoveries were made, but nothing of commercial venture, and then there was kind of a hiatus. We had abundant oil reserves produced in the lower 48, and it didn't appear that that would be a necessity. Even one of their naval petroleum reserves in Elk Hills came online, and there was plenty of oil for the Navy as well as for the rest of the nation. And so there was a kind of a period there of not much interest. And lo and behold, about 1943, as most of you will recall, some of us can remember, but some of you through history know that we were in World War II. And so again, renewed interest in the area because of its strategic location, as well as the fact that we might need some petroleum because some of our supplies of petroleum were interrupted by the war effort. After World War II, there was continued interest, and for the next 7 years, there were some 45 shallow wells drilled. There was discovery in three different areas of oil, as well as three separate areas from that of gas, none of which appeared to be commercial, and so interest waned again. And then, of course, there was renewed interest with the discovery of Prudhoe Bay. Husky Oil Company was commandeered then to continue looking. And there have been, since the first wells drilled, and there is a copy in your handouts, I would point your direction. It's a thing that looks like this on the front, which again delineates the NPRA with respect to Alaska, and then it's expanded, has a lot of measles on it. Those are the locations of the wells that have been drilled in the NPRA, and behind that is a tabulation of each of those wells, naming them. You may notice, however, that there is a dearth along the eastern border of the petroleum reserve, which is the Colville River. And that is where the renewed interest at current basis is, because of the Alpine discovery from ARCO and the development program that they have discussed publicly. The potential exists for that discovery or another discovery, because as some of you know, the best place to find oil is near an oil field. There is a discovery there that will be developed, and that there would certainly be, in all likelihood, more oil right across the boundary, which is the from the delta, which is the Colville River. I want to preface that there is no requirement for any environmental studies. There is nothing that has to be done from a government, federal government standpoint. The reserve is available for leasing. It's just that there hasn't been an expressed interest in it, or if the interest has been expressed, the federal government has not seen fit to renew leasing in there. And so what this document before you today would do is to send some support to our federal legislative triad that we would like to see a renewed interest and perhaps allow for leasing at least along the eastern border of the petroleum reserve, but there are other areas as well. And you may also be aware that the same problem occurs in ANWR, that if there is leasing from that period to the time of development would take considerable time. This would be a little less because the infrastructure would be preceded in effect by the development of Alpine. So things could happen a little faster. But in no way, and it's in your resolution, there is no way that the state would want to diminish its intensity of trying to open ANWR as well. This is not a replacement for ANWR. I want to make sure that everybody in the committee is aware. This is an addition to. There is one other nuance that this particular development would have that we don't have with any other development that is on federal land where hydrocarbons are developed. By agreement, the oil would be shared 50-50 with the federal government. That is a pre-existing agreement to development in the ANWR, in the NPRA, as opposed to ANWR, where there is still controversy about whether it would be a 90-10 or something in that range, as opposed to a pre-existing condition of 50-50 that's in NPRA. 90-10, for example, in the Moose Range in the Kenai field there. And that is a brief thumbnail. I think from another life, when I was a petroleum engineer, there is every evidence that there would be commercial production found on the eastern. And what I was trying to say with that map is, you'll notice there are no wells drilled in that particular area. So whether it would be an extension of the Alpine field or an ancillary development such as we found around Prudhoe Bay, would be conjecture, but the fact that there is source rock, there are reservoir traps, and they are apparently of commercial value, that's the reason for trying to get the state to push the federal government to allow for leasing. I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Representative Green. Would there be any questions from members of the committee? Representative Rowe.
Thanks, Chairman. Representative Green, I want to compliment you for not using the term PET 4. I had the opportunity to work with Husky Oil when they had the contract with the Navy on developing. Do you recall the time period that the Husky contract was, and they drilled about 15 or 16
About 15 wells, yes, and that would have been in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s.
Right, and Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, weren't some of those stratigraphic wells which were intended not to strike oil also?
There was. And as often the case, I don't know whether the committee is familiar with the term a strat well or an off-structure well. Quite often, The program has been to drill an information well. A lot of times they'll call it a cost well, COST, and it is an off-structure attempt to find out the geology, but not necessarily to discover anything of a hydrocarbon nature preparatory to leasing. It just says that, all right, you've done your seismic work, and this is a truth, ground truth, in the strat column that you can then apply whatever you want to do, your particular company may want to do as far as speed of reflections, delineating any kind of structural traps. And yes, some of the wells that Husky drilled were not actually intentionally looking for oil. They were looking for geological information.
And, Mr. Chairman, to follow up on that, some of the other wells, and particularly the earlier ones, really pretty shallow.
Very shallow.
So they really weren't wells in the sense that we would be drilling and exploring for today. Would that be okay?
Representative Roekberg, through the chair, yes, that is true. And a case in point to support that is the fact that there had been earlier wells drilled in the Colville Delta, non-commercial wells. It was only later, when they drilled deeper, that they found the Alpine discovery. So that's not an uncommon phenomenon, both in Alaska and in the lower 48, that the early development was too shallow to actually find the mother lode.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead, Mr.
Representative. Chairman, Representative Green, on page 3 in the last, be it resolved on line 4, use the words to take immediate action as far as the Department of Interior to conduct competitive lease sales within the National Petroleum Reserve of Alaska. I took note in the Governor's State of the State speech that he talked to the President, and he felt that he would be able to, I think, if I'm not misusing the word, to open up the National Petroleum Reserve by working very hard within 18 months to be able to get a leasing program going. And I thought that was rather strange, and I'd like to have your opinion, because I thought that the Petroleum Reserve was already open for leasing.
Representative Roper, through the chair, yes, you are right. And to me, that's subterfuge. Obviously, I don't want to mean mouth the leader of our country, but I think that just speaks to the fact that the administration does not share, perhaps, the urgency that most of us Alaskans do. There isn't anything necessary by the federal government other than the Secretary of the Interior to say, hey, we're going to open up for business. It is available for leasing. There isn't any reason for 18-month delay.
Mr. Chairman, to follow that up, are you aware with your background that like BLM or the MMS has to go through, I think, on a rigorous review before they offer the
inspection? Representative Roekberg, through the chair, the only thing I would be aware of would be similar to our own Division of Oil and Gas, that they may want to determine which areas they would want to put up, and that in a reasonable vein would probably take a couple of months, maybe. I can't imagine 18 months to say, okay, we realize that there is a discovery adjacent to us. It would behoove us as the federal government to allow leasing to make sure that since oil is a wild animal subject to the rules of capture, that we would want to make sure that our, being federal government, land is developed along with the state land that's being developed in the Delta.
Thank you. Representative Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Green, you had alluded to a lot of ifs, and so I'll ask you to do a little more crystal ball. Okay. If there is a lease, if they find commercially viable structure that includes oil, what kind of timeline are we looking at? I have heard in the ANWR debate that from the date they granted the lease to the first revenue to go into the general fund would probably be in the neighborhood of 10 years. Two questions. One is the timeline, and let me have you deal with that one first, and I'll ask my second if I may.
All right. Representative Bundy, through the chair. It's my opinion that this would be able to cut that timeline perhaps in half, and depending on the aggressiveness of their desire, could maybe even do less. Several of the issues that would confront us to getting ANWR open have already been done here. It's not that it's a pristine area that's not been drilled. It has been, as one of those plates showed you, over 80 wells have been drilled there. There would be infrastructure very, very close, especially if they were to lease and discover adjacent to Alpine. That development will probably be on stream under the current schedule sometime around the turn of the century. And if so, there would be an umbilical cord then for development in the NPRA area to tie into that near the village of New Ixit. The pipeline will, as it's envisioned now, it's my understanding, would come from the development area, the two drill sites, south, and then cut across and join a Kuparik drill site on the west side of that development. So the ability to drill, find the oil, and then transport it to a pipeline is significantly ahead of what would have to happen from the east side. There would have to be a pipeline corridor established. That in itself, from an environmental standpoint, would delay a number of, I would hope, months, I would fear years, just to get that pipeline in. So there are, that probably is the major difference, the infrastructure availability. So I would say perhaps half or less of that 10-year period.
Other questions, Representative Bundy?
Yeah, thank you. And you had made a statement about no environmental impact statement was required, but there would be construction of, an umbilical, an additional pipeline. I'm sure that there would be significant environmental oversight as that was attempted to be put in place.
Yes, Representative, through the chair, I would perhaps be a little remiss if I led you to believe there absolutely wouldn't be an EIS involved. It's quite doubtful that it would be necessary, more in the line of an assessment than an evaluation, so that the timeline, instead of 3 to 5 years, might be 1 to 2 years. And I think that's kind of where ARCO feels now about the Alpine development, that there wouldn't be the need for a full EIS, but perhaps more of an environmental statement and an acceptance. And the same thing then I think would apply to at least the east side. Now, as you move toward some of the more environmentally sensitive areas, Tashiput, or what, I can't pronounce it, one of those bays up there is a real environmental, I don't want to say hot spot, but it's very delicate. That obviously would take a full EIS, but that's several, many miles northwest of this area.
And if I might have one last question, this would be a unique situation, in, as you pointed out, it would be a 50-50 deal with the federal government and the oil. We'd be, it would all be transported via the TAPS pipeline. Does this change, does this offer any obstacles, the fact that it's just a change in percentage instead of the 90-10?
I wouldn't think so because, representing through the chair, I wouldn't think so because that agreement has been struck, and this is just another issue where I think the state of Alaska is honoring a prior agreement. We would say, all right, 50-50 was the deal that was granted, and we would live with that. It's the federal government who is impacting prior agreements rather than the state. They're trying to, what I would say, weasel, but I wouldn't really say that. I'd just maybe imply that.
Just between you and I.
That's right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bundy. Representative Vogan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Green, would you care to articulate for the benefit of the listening audience and possibly some of the newer members of the legislature the advantages of keeping oil flowing through the pipeline in regards to how it affects the royalty that the state receives?
Thank you, Representative Hogan. Through the chair, yes. There is a minimum volume that a pipeline that's 48 inches in diameter can efficiently transmit. I mean, if it gets down to numbers in the neighborhood of 200 to 300,000 barrels a day, your flow rate is so low that you can't efficiently to continue to operate. We're well above that right now, but as you've seen with Prudhoe Bay, there is a point at which production starts to decline from a field, and Prudhoe certainly is on that skid in spades now at about 10 to 12% per year. When you talk about a 900,000 barrel a day field, that's almost an oil field a year decline. I mean, it takes us some tremendous, we're talking about this Alpine development. Everybody's excited about 60,000 barrels a day. That does not offset the decline from Prudhoe Bay. It helps, but it doesn't offset it. So I think what you were referring to is the fact that the more of these small pods that we can get on, the longer we can continue to produce those areas that actually return the state more in more money than perhaps a marginal economic field that could produce for 8, 10, 12 years would help continue to produce a field like Prudhoe below what normally would then be its shutoff limit if it were a standalone field, because it would be down to, say, 200,000 barrels a day, can't continue to produce through the pipeline, so you shut it in prematurely. But if you can make up another 200,000 or 300,000 barrels a day at that time, which is going to be sometime in the next century, if you can make that up so that you're producing 500,000 or 600,000 barrels a day, of which something as lucrative as Prudhoe Bay is still producing two, then it can go on, maybe to 100,000 and that sort of thing. And so there is definitely an economy of scale, if you will, that we need to keep a minimum. And I don't know what that is, and I don't know that that's really been determined. Finitely, I think each company that owns part of TAPS probably has a different number, but it's, I'm going to say, somewhere in the neighborhood of 200,000 to 300,000 barrels a day.
Thank you, Representative Green.
One follow-up for me.
Yes, Representative Bogan.
I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, is it not true that the state's royalty share is based after transportation costs, and so the more oil we have going through, the actual more royalty we get per barrel because of the transportation costs? Is that a fair?
I don't think that's quite right. The amount of royalty is established by contractual agreement, and so when the barrel is produced, there is that subject to royalty. Now, what I think you may be referring to is that there is a reduction. Since we take our oil in value rather than in kind, we don't actually take ownership of the oil in most cases. There have been some contracts to where we have, but right now we're taking our oil in value, so much dollars. Well, there is a transportation and a cleaning dehy cost that is subtracted before we get our money. So we still get our full 1/8 or whatever, 1/5 at Milne Point, whatever the agreement has been, but the value that we get then is diminished by certain costs.
Thank you. We might also remember that when the pipeline shuts down, it has to be removed. So it's important for this committee to continue finding sources of oil to keep that pipeline going.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Green, a couple of quick questions. Why the renewed interest in the National Petroleum Reserve? I mean, currently, yes.
Well, obviously, excuse me, Representative Bryce, through the chair, the major interest is the fact that there has been a commercial discovery right next to it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, that wasn't true. The Kuparik River development ended,
yeah,
and so that there wasn't anything that would necessarily indicate that there was anything of value in the NPR area across the river. But with this discovery in the delta, right next, it's just across the main,
yeah,
channel, that really spurs interest, saying that there's a good likelihood, that there's no guarantee, but a good likelihood that either the existing Alpine field or an adjacent field might be found. And since now you've got the infrastructure, what would have maybe required a 60 to 100,000 barrel a day discovery, a field of, yeah, of magnitude to be able to produce that, now maybe a 30,000 barrel discovery over there would be economic because it has such a short pipeline to go.
So basically then it's based upon the Alpine discoveries. Okay.
Yes, and as I briefly skimmed over, there have been, yeah, two or three different time periods when there's an interest, and this is probably the fourth one now that has been an interest. There was during World War II, and then the Husky era, and now the Alpine era.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Kempler?
Yes, thank you, Chair. One of the statements before was that the President and the Governor have already agreed to a leasing program. Is that my understanding?
Yes, Representative Kemplin, through the chair, that's what we have been told, and there's no reason to doubt that. But the thing that was brought up earlier in the discussion is that maybe within 18 months we can do something. Perhaps this is a good idea. Those kinds of dodge the bullet type words, mm-hmm, bother me, in the fact that it seems that the job expands to the time allotted, and if we automatically say it's going to take at least 18 months, and that then it gets extended, we could be 2 or 3 years down the road under the agreement that has been reached between the governor and the president.
Mm-hmm.
And my position is that we need to really keep the fires turned up and see if we can't shorten that time frame. For example, the answer to one of the questions, why would it take 18 months? Why wouldn't it take 8 or 3 or 2 months? And so I think if we can do that with this kind of a resolution and then have our federal representatives turn the heat up again, perhaps we can get this done in a much shorter time.
I see. So it's basically asking them to make this a priority.
Exactly.
And shift its emphasis, make sure it bring it right up to the front burner.
Exactly.
I applaud your can-do attitude. Okay, thanks.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Ryan. Questions of Representative Green.
Morning, Representative Green.
Morning.
My understanding, and correct me because I'm not a petroleum or engineer or geologist, but that these pools of oil don't recognize any particular man-made boundaries.
Excuse me.
That's true. I also understand that the oil industry has some very good abilities to drill diagonally and other methods. As it, would it not be feasible perhaps to do a little claim jumping and to drill from our area down into the pool on a slant and realize some benefits from that sort of exploration?
Representative Ryan, through the chair, it certainly would be possible, and if I'm allowed to digress for a little while, the East Texas field is one of the oldest fields in the country, and this field is one of the classic developments. It's a long stratigraphic trap with an oil-water contact that has been water-flooded for 40 years, and they just gradually move the oil up to the pinch up where it's developed. And about 20 years ago, suddenly the boundaries of the East Texas field expanded. And this was a wonderful discovery. And they realized all of a sudden maybe there was some skullduggery going on. And so the Texas Railroad Commission demanded directional surveys of all these new discoveries. And there was a rash of well plugging going on. Same concept that I think you're alluding to. There are no-nos about going across your lease line with a directional well. And should you do that, you are in very, very difficult situation because those surveys would be a matter of record and you would actually be in trespass. In fact, our commission, our Conservation Commission, one of their major functions, which is hold solely with the Conservation Commission, not the Division of Natural Resources, and thank God we have that because that is the policeman of the oil industry saying they have a duty to protect correlative rights, the boundaries of their leases, as well as prevention of waste from the reservoir itself, wasting the hydrocarbon. And they would really, they'd be all over whoever did that, like ugly on an ape.
Thank you, Representative Green. Any further questions or comments for Representative Green from committee members? It's my intentions to pass this out today, with, unless you want to hold it over.
So. No, I would certainly appreciate, Mr. Chairman.
Would there be a public comment? Would there be, I didn't see anybody sign up. Is there anybody public comment on House Joint Resolution 12? Seeing none, we have a teleconference. What locations are we on? Anchorage and Fairbanks. Are there any comments from Anchorage or Fairbanks concerning House Joint Resolution 12? Are they on board? Thank you. Hearing none, I would return it to the committee. Any amendments or any further discussion on House Joint Resolution 12? Representative Rupert.
Mr. Chairman, I would suggest to the bill sponsor that I'm going to sign up as a co-sponsor on this this resolution. I think it's an excellent bill. And I would ask, perhaps when it reaches the Resource Committee, that they look at strengthening the language about immediate action so that it's clear. I see no need not to do this. So I'm prepared to make a motion right now to move this legislation unless there's further discussion from the committee.
Further discussion from the committee?
Mr. Chairman?
Thank you, Mr. Roper.
I move House Joint Resolution 12 with individual recommendations and the tax leave zero fiscal note.
With individual recommendations?
Right.
Yes. We have a roll call vote?
Well, there's no objections.
If there's no objections,
we need it.
We have unanimous consent. Any objections? Seeing none, passes out of committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
The next item of business before the committee is House Bill 51, Regulations of the Department of Environmental Conservation. Representative Rookford, would you like to make opening comments on House Bill 51?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Representative Norman Rookberg from District 11 in West Anchorage. And I want to thank the chairman for hearing this bill in a timely manner and at the very beginning of the session. It's unfortunate that I have to be before this committee one more time, because unfortunately the basic bill that is before you again was reviewed by this committee and other members and bodies of this legislature in the last session. But this House Bill 51 is a permutation and slight adjustment from what was House Bill 342, which was vetoed by the governor in the last session. Hopefully, with some minor revisions, the bill will proceed and gain the support of the administration. We hope to work closely with them in doing so. House Bill 51 is an important piece of economic development legislation and regulatory reform. To me, it was the centerpiece of regulatory reform in the 19th legislature, and hope will be the first of several of major pieces of legislation regarding regulatory reform in the 20th legislature. The bill's intent is to foster resource development within the state by endeavoring to simplify the regulatory process. Under the DEC's current regulatory system, adoption of federal changes in regulations, for example, the EPA, can take a considerable length of time. And there is no mandate in the statutes presently that requires a repeal of regulations if there is a change in federal regulations. And that is one of the primary intents of the bill, is to more closely track the EPA as the baseline because of the primacy of federal law in any area that the state deals with, that the theory being that we may not need any more stringent or restrictive requirements than is what allowed by federal law, which we are required to follow anyway. However, the bill does make provisions for deviating from federal EPA standards and placing more restrictive, less restrictive, or other standards within the body of water quality standards within the state of Alaska. So it's got substantial flexibility if the situation requires or warrants a more stringent standards, as apparently is the place, the case right now with, hopefully we'll find out from testimony from the department. During the last session, we discovered there was an estimate of between 6 and 8 regulations that were more stringent or deviated from the EPA requirements. Hopefully, we'll get a better count on that. This bill is supported by the 18-member Alaska Oil and Gas Association, the Resource Development Council, and I believe and the number of small placer miners, as well as the Alaska Mining Association. The first portion of the bill is the intent section, which is to provide the DEC with a view of the legislature. One reason I introduced this bill in the last session was that the prior administration had promulgated regulations and had hoped to have them adopted after working on it for some time on water quality standards. When the present administration came into office and upon the protests of environmental legal group stopped the promulgation of those regulations and went into meetings on various issues on the regulations. And over a period of approximately a year and a half, a private, what I considered closed door meetings between members of, for example, the Resource Development Council, the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund, and the administration, came up with some changes to those regulations and also agreements to further examine some regulations. Mr. Chairman, my feeling is that the proper form for establishing state policy is the legislature, and whereas the public has a right and ability to testify before a committee such as this and expressing their views about how state policy should be formulated. And I think that is, this is the proper format, not particular old, well, they usually don't have smoke-filled rooms anymore, or smokelessly filled rooms, or smokeless rooms in the various government buildings. I don't think decisions necessarily should be made there. It should be made in the full light of day with full public input. So that leads us to the bill itself, Mr. Chairman, which lists a number of water quality standards and measurements that must be taken into account when proposing, adopting, and applying water quality standards in this state. The bill provides that after receiving a request from a permit application, that the DEC shall within 90 days or another mutually agreeable time change the regulations in the state to conform with federal legislation or propose new state regulations, which may be more stringent, but they must go through the procedure as outlined in this bill. Mr. Chairman, I believe that the testimony in the last session on House Bill 342, and as evidenced by a letter of testimony that was given to your committee, and I don't believe it's been distributed yet, from the environmental community, indicates a lack of understanding on the part of a number of people of what this particular bill does. Because everybody seems to think on first reading of the statutory language that the DEC must make this change within 90 days, and they only have this very short period of time to do this and so forth, when a petitioner comes in and asks for a change. That's not the case. Number one, the 90-day window is for them to take action, but that action can be either to simply adopt the federal regulation, which they have statutory authority to do, I believe, under the bill, or propose a new regulation. And if they're to do so, they have to go through the standard Administrative Procedures Act period, which can be quite lengthy, provides for maximum public input, and so forth, if there is a change or they drop into the process provided under the bill, which they have to go through the public process, have public hearings, look at the various criterion and standards set up in the bill, which are, in essence, obstacles which have to be overcome by the department to make a more restrictive standard if it's warranted. This can take a period of well over a year. You know, so this is not, there's a great misconception about what the 90-day language means within the bill. I won't belabor that point. I'll go on to say that the bill establishes water quality criterion and measurements that must be made by the federal EPA methods or allows for substantially equivalent methods to be used by the DEC. The bill also authorizes the commissioner to establish a discharge standard for sediments and establishes the volumetric Imhoff cone method as the measurement for settable solids and discharged water. In the last session, Mr. Chairman, this was a highly controversial item, but a report which was finally issued in July of 1996, subsequent to the adjournment of the last legislature, did adopt the EPA standard for measurement of settable solids of the volumetric Imhoff cone. So after battling over this issue for some time, this bill merely reflects the now adopted standard, and hopefully that's one more hurdle we won't have to argue or battle the DEC over. Additionally, what we do is, and as the prime function or the main element of this bill, it establishes a process for the DEC to use when the department proposes regulations. Number one, it allows the DEC to adopt regulations that are more restrictive than federal criterion and going through the procedures as outlined in the bill. Secondly, it allows the DEC to establish a water quality standard for which there is no corresponding federal standard. In other words, they're authorized, if there's the believed need and a unique situation in the state, that they have the authority to go ahead and do that. It also allows the DEC to establish a state water quality measurement different from the measurement that EPA recommends. And lastly, the bill sets up a transitional review of the state water quality regulations that it coincides with the department's trying to review process. In other words, every 3 years, the department, by the Federal Water Quality Act, is supposed to review their existing regulations. Actually, in our statute, we give them 4 years because I believe they are a little bit behind in that process. What we don't want to do is create a substantial burden here. Also, I attention to trying to find the right to the NPDES permitting system. That was a change from last year's bill. Yeah, I'm trying to page 2, section 3. I understood that the DEC, and hopefully we'll have some testimony to this fact, that had wanted to take over the task of this permitting process in the state, which is the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System process. Mr. Chairman, you recall that the Kenai and Cook Inlet area just went through this process recently, lengthy public testimonies and so forth. It was conducted under the auspices of the EPA. There's recently been issued an MBDS permit for placer mining, I believe, in the state with some controversy surrounding it. But we had been led to believe that the state wanted to take on this process. But, Mr. Chairman, if you review the fiscal note that's attached to this bill, which we just recently received, apparently they may want to do this, but it would be a rather costly thing. So there's a $3.2 million addition to the fiscal note for the undertaking of this process. So therefore, Mr. Chairman, after we receive the testimony, I, in all probability, will be bringing forth an amendment to delete that section from this particular bill. I also like to point out that Representative Pete Kelly is the other prime co-sponsor or sponsor of this bill this session, and I'd like to also point out and thank my chief of staff, Mrs. Shirley Armstrong, in the audience for all the yeoman hard work she's done on this bill over a period of 2.5 years, and also the able assistance of Mr. Bruce Campbell from Representative Pete Kelly's office. Also, following me in testimony will be, hopefully over the teleconference, Becky Day Gay of the Resource Development Council and Marilyn Crockett of AOGA, which have been the prime resources and the technical support in very large part on this very long and arduous process, which we are now beginning again. I really want to thank them for all their help on this matter. The one thing, Mr. Chairman, you will find in your bill packets, the members of the committee, a committee substitute for House Bill 51, which reflects some changes in the original submitted draft. And if the chairman would allow me, or would wish to, I would be happy to go through the changes for that, and then we can submit the CS for discussion before us. It may simplify the process somewhat.
Please do, Representative.
Okay, if you will look on your on the CS, page 1.
Excuse me just a moment.
Do you have a copy? Mr. Chairman, did you want a motion to adopt this as our working document?
Need that first.
Sorry, oh, we can do that now, right.
I would move that we adopt this CS as our working document.
Any objections to adopting the CS for House
Version
Bill
F?
51? Version
right.
F.
Version F.
Thank
okay.
you.
Right. Any objections? Seeing none, so done.
Mr. Chairman, there's a few minor changes. These changes came out of discussions with members of my staff and Representative Kelly's staff with the meeting with the DEC on a first blush go around, and we've endeavored to make some of these changes here. First is on the first page, line 13. You'll see we've added the words that the department considers whether compliance with the regulation is economically feasible. What we've done here, Mr. Chairman, is try to lessen the impact, particularly in terms of financial impact, by allowing the department just to consider this rather than to mandate a specific use. We've also, on line 15, used the rather straightforward word science rather than by deleting scientifically measurable criteria. We have made the very strong point here that the regulation is based on science. I mean, this seems rather a simple notion, but quite frankly, it seems to have caused some difficulty in the past. Nevertheless, we've agreed to do that. On page 2, line 16, we changed the word background condition, and there's a long history behind this. I won't go into development, but we believe this more properly serves the vernacular and terms of art used within water quality standard criteria language. And, Mr. Chairman, unfortunately, in my involvement with this bill, I know more about these things, which are very, very complex, than I care to know. But I still have I know nothing.
Yes, Representative.
I'm sorry, perhaps I misunderstood. Line 16?
Yes.
Where's
on the original.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Bill.
I'm on the CS here.
Yes.
Excuse me. You're exactly right. Right. Where am I?
I see background on line 10. Page
it would be.
Oh, I'm looking at the. I'm sorry, Representative Bunny. I'm on the. I'm working off the original bill here.
Oh, okay.
Continue, Representative Rutberg.
Right. Yeah. It is the original bill. Just for clarification. Right. It's line 16 there.
Would be line 26
of the CF. I'm sorry, yeah, that's what I was going to wait to. I have adopted later, excuse me. My notes are based on the original bill. Looking at the original bill on line 18, the word and is deleted in criteria, and let's see, where is that in the. Just wandering around.
Section
like C. Temporary at ease. On the CS line 28, where it reads, show you a scientific justification to develop water quality standards which can be relied upon. We got section 5 there under this section. It's at the very top of page 3. Right? That reads now, I shall provide procedures, which is added to, for permitting mixing zones and state bodies of water. And moving over to on line 6, page 3 of the original bill. Is added. This has to do with a 90-day period, and this is at the request of the department. Also, Mr. Chairman, if we fundamentally page 2 of the CS for the addition of which fundamentally defines the term background conditions. This whole subsection has been added. And as I mentioned in my testimony, I, in all probability, will bring amendment. At that, Mr. Chairman, I conclude my testimony and prepare to ask any questions or unless you want to go ahead and take testimony.
Yes. My intentions would be to move this out at your discretion. When would you like to see this come up for?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that we need to see how much testimony is involved here.
Yes.
And use our best judgment.
Right.
I would like to see it move, but if there's, I want to make sure the public has the opportunity to do this, and we have to hold it over, we'll have to hold it over.
Then you're prepared with the amendments that you mentioned.
Well, the one right now.
Okay.
But,
okay. Right. Great. Representative Bundy?
Yeah, just a question to clarify my understanding. I think I heard you say that the federal regs had supremacy over our state regs. But then I thought I also heard say that this bill would allow the state to establish its standards the same as, more stringent than, or less stringent than. Is that the case?
Okay. I'm informed we have taken the less out. But historically, there's been situations, particularly like we're having a battle, Mr. Chairman, over arsenic right now, where there's a differential or a difference between the federal government, the scientific community, and the mining community,
and the DEC here. So there's an ongoing controversy.
Mr. Chairman, the purpose of my question was not that I have all that much confidence in the federal standards. It's just that they're going to have supremacy, and we encourage someone to establish a lower standard. I don't know if we need more court suits.
Right.
Any other questions? Oh, excuse me. Representative Ryan, a question?
Yes, Representative Roper, you, in your bill, you had the economic feasibility of the regulations of the department. You came back with a fiscal note of $297,600 to justify the hiring of three economists, two full-time and one part-time, or one, excuse me, three full-time, different grades. To ascertain that economic feasibility. You did mention in your testimony that and on page 1, line 15, regulations based on science is a new concept for the department, science. Have you consulted with the department of how much it's going to cost to hire the scientists necessary to ascertain whether that is reasonable?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ryan, no, I have not. Specifically, we've had some discussions preliminarily, but I think your question is better directed to the department.
Thank you.
Chairman, I know that Ms. Gay and Ms. Crockett are willing to stand by, so I'm ready, unless there's any further questions.
We have one more question from Representative Kemplin.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I was just looking at the fiscal notes section of the packet. And there was you mentioned that you were going to bring forth an amendment regarding the fairly substantial costs that were identified by the department related to this NPDES. And I was wondering if you could address these other costs that were identified by the department and how it's expected to meet those costs. I think they mentioned there's some legal costs and regulation costs and are those accurate assessments in your mind here from the department who's going to be responsible for administering this legislation? I guess I'd like to get a feel for the numbers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kemplin, the answer to that is no.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that we'll have further discussion on this. And I believe that the existing department budgets, personnel, and so forth, in large part, can accomplish the substantial portion of it. There may be some relatively modest costs to go through the regulatory procedures that would result under the Administrative Procedures Act from the implementation of the statute. But as to the fact of, for example, needing a full-time attorney, I don't agree with that.
Mm. Mr. Chairman,
continue,
I guess I was at the Resource Development Conference that was held recently in Anchorage, and a representative from the mining community, in his presentation to the conference, mentioned that the efforts to reduce the available resources to DEC could be significantly detrimental to the mining industry. And because of their ability to get permits through the system. And his suggestion was that we'd be very careful about reducing the budget of that department. And your statement that these costs that are associated with this new legislation could be absorbed by the department seems to run contrary to the statement that I'd heard earlier. And I guess I'm just like to be assured that the industry is not going to be negatively affected because the the governmental administration is burdened with too many responsibilities and not enough resources.
Representative Roper.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kaplan, I appreciate your concerns, and I also share it. I mean, I do not, and it's not the intention of this bill, in any way to have a negative impact on the ability of the department to meet the needs of the private sector when they come forward for their permitting process. You will find, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kaplan, as you have a longer tenure in this particular building, that there seems to be a desire on the part of bureaucracy to find rationales and abilities to increase their monetary income, which is only a natural function of any bureaucratic organization. Mm-hmm. You always need to be mindful of that. And the ability of the department to act properly is a case to be made before their budget subcommittee. And I'd like the chair to know that fundamentally the same bill, with the exception of the MPDES permitting section, left the Senate Finance Committee, or was waived by, or left the Senate resources with its fiscal note of $60,000 last session. Mm-hmm. And this particular budget argument about fiscal impact is one that will go on in the course of this bill.
Any further questions of Representative Roper? Thank you, Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I would like to move on to the testimony of Hudley. And I would ask that we move to the teleconference. And I believe we have Becky Gay has signed up. Can she? Okay. Becky Gay, go ahead if you would clearly state your full name, affiliation, and title.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Becky Gay. I'm the Executive Director of the Resource Development Council, which is a federally funded nonprofit, a statewide organization working on research issues of all kinds. Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify today. And in particular, I want to thank Representative Roberg and his staff, Shirley in particular, and Representative Kelly and his staff, Bruce, for all the work they've done on this bill over the last few years, because it's been quite a few years getting here on this bill. I hope you have my comments and that I were written for your packet. They did refer to the former bill, HD 51, not to the CS, so I'll tailor my testimony today to reject the CS. But I will agree with Representative Roper that over the interim, since the former bill, HD 342, which was the water quality bill last year, passed and was vetoed, we've worked really closely, we being RDC and the regulated community, with the agencies and with other public to address what perceived shortcomings there were in the bill. And to the extent that we could agree, we made changes, and I think the bill reflects that. And I'll point out a couple of places where DEC changes in particular were factored in and by Representative Roper during the process. And then I also really hope that the legislature understands that a lot of this work is in response to the decline in budget revenues, and not just to the Department of DEC, but to the whole state. And although RDC works primarily on the revenue side of the budget, like trying to get more industry here and use our resources to produce wealth, we are not shy of mentioning things where we believe costs could be cut. And in the regulatory arena, we believe that some of that cost cutting can be useful and some of it can be painful, and we are here to kind of help guide the way through these rocky seas, hopefully with the legislature and the administration and the regulated community being able to come to some agreement. Because I think the real word is congruence. There just needs to be more congruence in the state about what we're going to do, and the use and protection of water in particular is what is addressed in this bill. We believe that will minimize a lot of wasted effort from all parties, and it will strengthen the agency's internal resolve to do what is necessary and mandated. And it'll also, that kind of congruence will show a united front to EPA and perhaps reduce some of the lawsuits that are always threatened, that come of vagueness and ambiguity in direction from the legislature from which these regulations are promulgated. For instance, currently there is no state adjustment policy, as Mr. Roseberg pointed out, on regulations. The legislature needs to decide what that policy is, and I think it's clearly stated in this bill, because the federal requirement is merely to adjust upward if they become more restrictive. That's a one-way street for a state. And if the regulations change at the federal level, there is no similar requirement, mainly because the feds don't care if you're stricter than the Fed, to somehow adjust downward when the feds determine one of their criteria are lacking. We do believe that that's a useful, I mean, it will become useful if and when the Clean Water Act is changed. However, that's just an adjustment policy, and we believe the legislature is the right place to debate what that policy would be and to determine it in fact. Also, the bill, HB 51, it requires DEC to set standards which are scientifically supportable. We just cannot stress how important that is. Consistent with federal existing standards, so we don't keep getting sideways with the feds if unnecessarily, and be realistic for Alaska. And this is where that background language really comes in. That's the kind of thing that will Alaskanize our regulations, which is what the Clean Water Act has asked each state to do. Where possible, HB 51 also gives statutory backing for DEC efforts that are already underway. Now, this new fiscal note on MPDES I'll address in a minute, but that is a new addition in the bill, so I don't believe that that has been discussed legislatively enough, but it was my understanding that it is DEC's intent to indeed take over MPDES, and I certainly know it's Region 10's intent to give it to the state should they want it. So I think that that will be a useful debate at this committee and onward through the process. So I hope you don't scrap it too soon in terms of maybe we might want to tone down the language such that they don't have to take it over if they decide it's too expensive or whatever. But I do think that it's useful to have it in the bill for dialogue, because DEC keeps using that as a ultimate goal for other things. And if other things conflict with that ultimate goal, more importantly, then those other things won't happen. So I think that needs to be explored with DEC publicly. It also, as Neil Arm said, it does specifically allow in two places for the state to have a stricter standard than the feds. And that's what the opposition seems to make the most noise about. If DEC can prove scientifically that there's a reason to have stricter standards, then indeed they can have them. And there is a process laid out by which to do so that's quite clear, in my opinion. It also allows DEC to have this standard that's not in law. That was DEC's language. They're the ones suggesting that there even should be such a thing. We acquiesce to that last session. I'm not sure where they're doing that already, but we don't have a problem with them doing it. If they can prove that they should. So this bill also allows a discharge water language to match the quality of the receiving waters. And I think that there has been a change in the CS, but I would offer an additional change or maybe an addition here in a second. And there's a statutory mandate for mixing zones, which I think is going to be increasingly important. The state is trying to promulgate regs on mixing zones right now, but they don't really have clear statutory backing to do so. And this would just take the argument out of that. Now, I'm turning to the bill, if I still have time, and there's only two of us here to testify, so unless you have a statewide teleconference, I appreciate the protection if it takes it. Page one, about the economist.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, could I ask which version she's referring to?
I'm referring to the CS now.
Okay, thank you.
I'll try to continually refer to the CS, since that's the bill, I think, in front of us. The new section two, the whole section there. We've long been wishing that DEC would hire an economist. We think that the economic argument is lost many times in the regulatory arena, and that it's a real important aspect. I don't know if it would take hiring an economist. I think you could get the whole department taught economics 101 and a public finance course that would move all of them along the curve of being responsible to fiscal constraint in a useful manner. However, I don't think that the fiscal note on that is necessarily real. If they do want to hire three economists, I think you might be able to get with the university at ICER and have them do that on an ongoing basis. But I also jokingly might say the guys could turn out to be real Maytag kind of guys, you know, Maytag repairman, because it's not like they promulgate regs very rapidly. So mixing zones alone have taken 3 or 4 years to get there. And so they'd have plenty of time, just probably with one economist, to do that job. With regard to page two now, on the addition to background condition, I think this is really good. I know it mirrors the state of Washington. If I had anything to say about this in a critical manner, it would be I would delete the last sentence about that you can use a similar watershed. I'm not sure what that really means, but it doesn't really have any red flags. I do think it's real important that Representative Roseberg has tried to take a definition of background, because last year we spent a lot of time talking about what was natural condition, natural background, existing quality, all of those things, and now we just have a definition that works regulatorily, and I'll be interested to see if DEC shares that view. Going down that page, the addition on section 3 to MPDES, again, it's my understanding that it is DEC's intent to take over MPDES at some point in time. I don't think that the fiscal note is really realistic in the sense it's one-sided. Like, it doesn't show any program receipts, which you're supposed to get if you do take over the MPDES program, and it doesn't show any federal funds that might come along associated with it. I think that that should be fleshed out a little bit more before it's denied, but I think it's useful to have a number out there to talk about, because DEC itself is continually suggesting they're going to do this, and we're always wondering how they're going to, but we do understand that it will take statutory language to do so, and legislative backing to give them the money to do it. So I guess I'd want to know if DEC really wants it or not before you deleted it. Moving down that page, on 22, the reference to the Clean Water Act, that was added because DEC and EPA both made comments that we weren't referring to it in this section, and so now it's in there. That was responsive to DEC. The changes to background, I have no problem with, as I mentioned. I think that's a good change. On line 30 and 31, the concept of receiving water is still not in that message. So I don't know whether you want to add language that says receiving water. It's not just the water received by the user. So I'd be happy to entertain questions on that, but I did give you some language, so I won't go over it unless you ask me to. Turning to page 3, the mixing zones, again, that's good to have it in there that we are going to have mixing zones. That will help us later, and help DEC later, too, because they're trying to permit them. The 3, 4, 5 on that page, the accept water study standards, that's an example of where the state is going to be stricter than the Fed, and where we built that right into the bill. That was an ADF and G request last year, and they pointed out that they are always stricter on shellfish beds with reference to fecal coliform. And that made sense to us, and so we put it right in the bill that they'll always be stricter there. So that's the kind of, you know, effort was made last year to respond to the agencies. Like, similarly, on line 9, that 90 days that Norm referred to, that was DEC's number. They don't necessarily want to defend that number now, but they did come up with that number themselves. And I will point out that APA, the Administrative Procedures Act, which is what they have to use now, only has a 30-day time limit. So they got three times as much time than the Administrative Procedures Act allows them to do this. And so we think we were responsive there. On line 21, I haven't mentioned this to the sponsors, so excuse me, but I did read back through the EPA letter that was talking about the bill earlier, and they recommended deleting the methods approved in writing. They wanted to delete the in writing part. They said EPA doesn't always approve things in writing, and that they didn't want to get hung up always trying to write stuff to the Alaska. I don't have a problem with deleting that. Someone else might. Seemed like it was just make more work for the EPA, and they didn't like that. Similarly, in line 26, that was the Inhoff Cone method has been bought into by the state and their own study, so that's a moot point, but I just wanted to bring up that DEC got that amendment last year, so that again was kept in the bill as a DEC responsive issue. And then, moving to the next page, page 4, the reference to being less restrictive was specifically taken out of Representative Bundy asked that question, because DEC couldn't defend it and wouldn't defend it at the governor's level in particular. This became a huge point. So if DEC wants to be less restrictive than the Fed, they're going to have to come back and seek legislative approval on their own if they want to. They're trying to be less restrictive than the Feds on arsenic, so we really saw in all good faith that we were giving them statutory backing to do so. They kind of looked that gift horse in the mouth, so I think that's up to the committee. But it does, unless it's specifically in here, I think the question to Representative Bundy's question is, this bill gives DEC ultimate regulatory ability and statutory backing to do what they think is right. Except there's certain sideboards that are outlined in this bill that they have to adhere to when they're making those decisions. And I think that's the congruent part that we like about having the legislature give some direction. And the very last part on page four, and then I'll end my testimony there, about the transitional review and the triennial review. This was DEC's change last year, because when we came in with this bill, we asked for a review of all regulations, historic and any ones they were in the middle of. DEC complained that that cost too much money. And a long fight over that during last session was, what happened was we acquiesced to their request to do it within the triennial review process, knowing full well that a triennial review, although that means 3 years, really takes about 6 years, and sometimes maybe longer. So we feel that we gave a lot on that issue already, that the triennial review process, but at least at looking at things that are in place now. So I wanted to just point that out as we go through this. We worked really closely with the agency to make this a much more palatable bill, even in light of the fact that most of the difference of opinion seems to be philosophy, whether or not the legislature should indeed give the direction, and we believe that it should. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Becky Gay. Is there any questions from the committee members pursuant to the last testimony? Seeing none, I would ask Marilyn Crockett from Anchorage on teleconference.
Certainly. Good morning. This is Marilyn Crockett. I'm the Assistant Executive Director for the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. AOGA, for those of you who may not be familiar with us, is a trade association of 18-member companies who account for the majority of the oil and gas exploration, production, transportation, and marketing activities in the state of Alaska. AOGA worked, as Representative Roper has identified earlier, for quite a long time last session on this bill. We participated in the various subcommittee and committee hearings that were held in discussions with DEC. And we continue to support the goal of this legislation to establish reasonable and economically achievable and scientifically based state water quality standards that are no more stringent than the federal regs, unless on a case-by-case basis there's evidence that justifies the more restrictive regulations. Specifically, we support legislation that would provide for state regulations and standards to be consistent with the federal requirements. If circumstances warrant a different standard at the state level than at the federal level, there should be some process in place that allows for consideration of science and economics in the demonstration of that more restrictive requirement. And I would point to the section that talks about the review that would be undertaken for a water body, or for a standard, excuse me, that would be more restrictive than the federal regulations. And one of the things that some folks may not know is that that section was crafted using language from the Alaska statute authorizing state assumption of the Title V air program. And that legislation was drafted by a work group prior to submittal by the governor to the legislature that reached consensus on that point, that the regulations at the state level should be consistent with the federal level. However, there may be situations where you may want to have a more restrictive regulation for whatever purpose. And in those cases, you have to go through a demonstration process. In fact, there's an additional piece in the Title V program that requires peer review, and that was subsequently eliminated from the House Bill 342 last year. So that language mirrors the Title V requirements, and we thought that was valuable. Secondly, there should be an efficient way to amend state regulations to match federal regulations when they change. And we support regulations that would specify only EPA-approved measurement methods. As Becky pointed out earlier, right now the state's required only to amend its regulations when changes to the federal regulations result in a more restrictive standard than we have at the state level. The state should ensure that there's consistency with the federal requirements, and should the state be required, and the state should also be required to amend state standards when changes occur to the federal standards, which result in a less restrictive standard, or the provisions, for that matter, are deleted from the federal regulations. Federal regulations should be the basis as well as the boundary for state regs. If there's a legitimate need for more restrictive standards, then a process should be in place to ensure that science and economics are considered as part of that process. Finally, this bill provides an appeal process, which we believe is important, to effect changes to the state requirements when changes to the belt requirements are enacted. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Would there be any questions from the committee on to Marilyn Crockett? Representative Roper?
Mr. Chairman, Marilyn, and perhaps even Becky could comment on this. Do you know if there's any, what if any debates going on in Washington, D.C. on in the revisions of the Clean Water Act now? Were there not some suggested changes a couple of years ago and then the political will kind of died there, or what's going on there?
Any further questions, Representative Roper?
No questions.
Representative Kemplin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions of Marilyn Crockett?
Yes. Ms. Crockett, I guess my question is regarding this the economics issue and the economic analysis that is to be performed. Who, from your understanding, do you think that a couple of courses in economics at the undergraduate level would be sufficient to provide an accurate assessment of the economic viability of these regulations? Or do you feel that a trained economist is necessary?
Through the chair, this is Marilyn Crockett. You know, I guess I'm not really qualified to answer that question. I'm not an economist myself. I can tell you that at the EPA level and at other agencies, there are requirements for consideration of economics and the economic impact from regulations. I believe that guidance documents could be prepared which would spell out specifically what must be considered as part of the regulatory development process. That would be a great assistance to regulation writers as they're drafting these standards.
Further questions, Representative Kemplin?
No, thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Becky Gay and Marilyn Crockett in Anchorage. I would now go to the sign-up sheet that we have here. We have a Janice Adair. Could you please state your name and affiliation?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Janice Adair. I'm the Director of the Division of Environmental Health, and I'm also the Department's Legislative Liaison for DEC. It's hard to know where to start because we have several answers to some of the things that have been put out here today, but let me assure the committee that the Department certainly agrees that it is the role of the legislature to set policy, and I don't want there to be any confusion on that point. We see the bill as actually being significantly different than House Bill 342 in two regards. The first is Section 2, which sets out the economic feasibility and based on science. And we agree that science is an important basis for any environmental regulation. And Section 2 does apply to all regulations of DEC, not just water quality, but drinking water, pesticides, solid waste, contingency plans, oil transportation, contaminated sites, the entire gamut of environmental regulations adopted by this department. The primary basis of environmental regulation is protection of public health, and in nowhere in this bill is that concept included. And when you have a choice between economic feasibility, particularly in some of these program areas like drinking water or protecting public health, we read Section 2 as always deferring to the economic feasibility, and that is a great concern. We know that lead in drinking water is a health problem for children, and we have a requirement that there be no lead pipes, no lead solder. That may not be economically feasible for the people being regulated, but I think it's an important health protection. We know that cryptosporidium exists in our surface water sources here in the state, and we know that cryptosporidium killed 100 people in Milwaukee in 1993. So we have requirements for filtration that are expensive, but we think that on balance, it's worth it. Likewise, there are societal choices, and that's why science alone isn't the answer. There are choices that society makes about the protections of their environment. Mixing zones is a perfect example. Mixing zone is not a scientifically created entity. It's a societal choice. It's something that we have said as Alaskans, we're willing to have a water body, have a single user, essentially, the person discharging into the mixing zone, and preclude other uses of that water body for fishing, for shellfish growing, for swimming, or whatever else you might want to do in that water body. So those are important concepts for us and things that we try to strike the balance between when we go out with a regulatory proposal. The MPDES delegation language in Section 3. We think that MPDES being run by the state would be good for the state. But because it's expensive, we haven't done it. And the fiscal note reflects, it is our honest assessment of what we think it would take, and it's why we don't do it. It's very expensive. It is true, it does not reflect our fiscal note doesn't reflect federal grants, because typically there are no federal grants for running this program, so we wouldn't expect to get any. It also doesn't reflect any program receipts, because we have no program receipt authority for this, nor did this legislation propose that. So we had to go with what was written, which would all come from general funds. We're going out with a contract, I don't think it's been issued yet, to have a look at what it would really take to have MPDES. This is our best estimate, but I think it's a few years old, as I recall. And we need to get a handle on it, because there is a lot of interest in having the state run MPDES. And we think that actually some of the angst that's been expressed by the legislature about water quality standards is a direct result of the fact that there are essentially two water distribution programs in the state. There's a federal program and there's a state program. So we think that delegation could be an answer, but we don't really know. So the fiscal note should not be read as an indication from us that we don't want it, but we just recognize it's expensive. The bill says that water quality standards shall protect human health and the propagation of fish, but the Clean Water Act requires that water be protected for a variety of other uses. And we don't see those uses in there, and that is a concern to us. If we were to try to obtain delegation of the MPDES program, would we actually be able to do it if this were to become law? For example, the Clean Water Act requires that water be protective of wildlife, recreation, domestic water supplies, drinking water, because a lot of drinking water comes from these water sources, agricultural, industrial, navigational uses. So those are all things that we need to consider when we adopt a water quality standard. It also says that the discharged water can't be of higher quality than the background condition of the receiving water, and we think that that's probably okay, but this is something that we needed to clarify with EPA, and we have not had the opportunity to do so yet. We do know that in some cases EPA requires a technology-based limitations on the effluent and without regard to the receiving water, so that could be a problem. It's something that we would need to look into. It requires that standards be reliably measured. And in theory, that's sound. But we do have what I call aesthetic standards. I think the technical term is narrative standards. They're not a measurement. It's not a numeric standard where you can say we've measured it. It's color, it's taste, it's aesthetics. And I don't know how you reliably measure that. Likewise, there are some standards that go to non-detect. And I think, personally, that you could reliably measure non-detect, but I'm not sure if the Attorney General's office would agree with me, and we haven't had the opportunity of their review for this yet either. It is correct that we have adopted within our regulations the requirement that settleable solids be measured with the Imhoff Cone method. But one of the reasons that we like to have specific requirements in a regulation is because then if somebody comes up with a better mousetrap, or for some reason, and I am not suggesting that there's something out there like this, but if somebody wants to do something different, our hands are tied if it's in statute. And we can say, well, yes, we know you don't want to use this, you want to use that, but the statute